It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, we'll get the latest on criminal investigations into former President Trump related to efforts to overturn the 2020 election results. First, inflation is cooling down significantly. Last month, it hit a two-year low with a 3% increase. That's getting closer to the Federal Reserve's target of 2%. It could be a turning point for the U.S. economy, but the Fed isn't declaring victory quite yet. Our next guest is with us for a look at some of the causes of longer-term inflation, including accusations of greedflation, where companies keep charging more because they can. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you noticed price changes lately at the grocery store, the gas pump? Are you able to afford rent or a house in the community you want to live in? What questions do you have about the long-term progress, the saga of inflation? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Lydia DePillis is a reporter on the business desk at the New York Times. Lydia, welcome back to Central Time.
Good to be with you.
This 3% number sounds pretty good compared to where we were, say, a year ago in particular, a big drop from then. How big a deal is this one data point from last week?
Well, it's certainly really good to see. It's down from 9% back in June 2022, but it's not a done deal at the moment. And that's what you'll see the Fed be concerned about going forward. This is a well-timed conversation coming right before the July Fed meeting tomorrow, where they will decide how much to raise interest rates again. One thing I would note is that the 3% number is all types of goods and services. Mm-hmm. The Fed tends to pay closer attention to is the core rate, and that's stripping out food and energy, which tend to be a lot more volatile, and they just cycle up and down a lot more quickly. So when they look at the core, that's still running pretty hot. It's fallen, but not quite as much. And so that's what they're going to want to see come down further before they really declare victory and go home.
I wonder about a perception gap over inflation, because I feel like as a consumer myself, I notice energy prices, gas prices that are on signs everywhere you walk and drive, food prices I notice when I go grocery shopping. How much of a gap can there be between our perception as consumers and what the Federal Reserve and others are looking at when it comes to inflation?
Yeah, that's a good point, because when you look at the graph of year-over-year inflation rates and you see it coming down, that looks really great. But it's not saying that prices are coming down. It's just saying that prices are growing less quickly. So if you think back to 3 years ago, you know, your broccoli or your gas or your car insurance are still going to be quite a bit more than they were back then, on average about 21% more. So until you see prices actually fall, which we're not sure will happen, it's still going to be a frustrating situation for consumers.
Now, there have been big, long arguments, some of them on this show, about what drove that inflation. And people point toward, you know, post-COVID demand plus supply chain difficulties, government spending in the U.S. and elsewhere, the war in Russia and Ukraine. Some of those are in the rearview mirror, I think, mostly, obviously not the Russia-Ukraine war. What do people point to as factors for the inflation rate coming down from that peak last year?
Yeah, and you know, the fight I find kind of dumb, because obviously all of those things played a role, and economists have offered many explanations for how much of a role each one played. So there's room for debate around that. But in terms of why inflation has fallen, so it's funny because at the outset, the Fed got a lot of flack for saying that we think inflation is transitory. It's going to be over before you know it. Obviously, that was wrong, but it was wrong in the short term. In the long term, there's a lot of goods and services that came back down kind of naturally as a reversion to the mean, right? We see this most pronounced in the price of goods, because those were the things that we all bought all at once, driving up the price, combine that with supply chain snarls, made them very scarce and drove up the prices very high. Now, all of that is clearing out, right? Like those long backups at the ports are pretty much resolved. Most factories are back online. We've stuffed our houses as full as they can get. with new couches. And so that kind of those kinds of prices are pretty much almost back to where they were. Now, the thing that is continuing and preventing inflation from sinking as quickly are some of your prices, right? Your haircuts, your amusement parks. And that's because what followed the run up in prices was workers saying, we need better wages in order to afford the new cost of living, which then drove up the price of services, which has prevented the overall rate from falling as much as it could have.
We're talking about the latest inflation news with Lydia DePillis from the New York Times. You can join in with your thoughts, your questions, your experiences at 800-642-1234. Lydia, one fundamental cost that people are facing if they want to find a new place to live, housing, a report by the National Low Income Housing Coalition found if you are a minimum wage worker, there is no state, county, or city in the United States where you can afford a two-bedroom apartment. How do things like housing factor into how we measure inflation?
Yeah, well, I mean, the minimum wage statistic you cited probably is more a commentary on the minimum wage than it is about the price of housing. But so that is one of those goods that, so when we talked about why inflation is falling, right, I sort of neglected to mention the Fed's increased interest rates, right? Because that was its remedy to sky high inflation. It wanted to make borrowing more expensive, which makes businesses slow down. They don't hire as much. People don't have as much spending power. And so they don't spend as much on goods and services. So the prices come down, right? So so that translated pretty quickly into the housing market, right? Because if you need to borrow a bunch of money to buy a home, instead of 3% interest rates, you're going to have to pay 7, 8%. And that adds hundreds of dollars for a monthly payment, which has driven up prices even higher than they were just naturally because people were moving into bigger spaces. People were decoupling from family members because they wanted to separate out and move to further out locations during the pandemic, right? So all of that has driven up the cost of housing a ton. And it hasn't really been falling because we have this very constrained supply. And the irony of that is that interest rates operate in a couple of different ways. One is trying to suppress the prices, but the other is suppressing construction. So the fact that builders now have to pay more for construction loans has made it so that it's harder to build apartments. So that supply is slowing down, and also single family homes. And also it's made it so that people who already own their homes, the last thing they want to do is sell it if they'd have to turn around and buy something else at a much higher interest rate. So all of that is combined to make it a really frustrating situation for anyone who's trying to buy a home. If you're trying to rent a home, prices are coming down gradually. That's part of the picture in what's bringing down overall inflation. But again, those prices are a lot higher than they were at the before the pandemic started.
Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Chris is with us in Wauwatosa. Chris, hi.
Hi, I just wanted to, the caller or the speaker was talking about inflation and workers' wages. And it just seems like nobody ever really talks about the impact that more money flowing to the top and larger profit margins and payouts to like shareholders and stuff, how that never, it seems like that's never talked about.
Chris, thanks a lot for the call. And you have talked about this elsewhere, Lydia, accusations of greedflation, the idea that companies can boost their profits by keeping prices higher because we're used to paying higher prices.
Yeah, there's been a lot of debate around this. And I do think it is an element of what we're seeing, right? All of these factors are playing a role in inflation. When inflation is high because of initially all of these supply chain issues we talked about, that makes it a lot easier for corporations to say, well, consumers expect prices to be high, so maybe we can hide a little extra profits amongst all of that. And so you really did see profits spike. And, you know, some orthodox economists will usually say, well, it's just supply and demand. When supply is down, prices go up. That allows the market to clear, but it does manifest in much higher profits. And it also, companies have gotten used to those profits. And if they're very large companies that have a greater share of the market than they might have 10, 30 years ago, they are able to exert pricing power and keep those prices higher for longer. And we really have seen this in particular in the car market, some of the consumer packaged goods like your chips and sodas. So that is absolutely a factor. We're not totally sure on how much it's actually driven inflation, but you're not wrong to think, Chris, that that is a feature. And when it comes to wages, so we actually have seen some of the biggest wage increases in decades for especially low wage workers, which has been really encouraging, but they haven't felt it very much because inflation has been higher. And only recently has that started to turn around, where wage growth is moving faster than inflation, putting more spending power in people's pockets. Hopefully those wage gains will stick around while inflation is falling, making it a little bit easier to make ends meet.
Thanks a lot for that call. We're talking to Lydia DePillis, reporter on the business desk at the New York Times. We're talking about a decline in the inflation rate in the latest data, what that could mean for the American economy, and the prices we pay for stuff. You can join in at 800-642-1234. How has inflation affected your household budget? Are you feeling the cooling effects of lower inflation this summer or not? Is there a particular item that's challenging for you, whether it's housing or you needed a new car or something, or maybe just your grocery bill that stood out to you as you're paying a lot more than you used to? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our conversation about inflation and all of its cousins, greedflation, wageflation, shrinkflation, maybe even some Beyonceflation. Economics reporter Lydia DePillis from the New York Times is here to help us sort it all out. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you noticed the impact on your life of higher prices over this last year? Are you seeing any relief? What questions do you have? Call 800-642-1234. Back to your calls now. Jim is with us in Dubuque. Jim, hi.
Hi. A couple things. We've talked about how inflation is going down. I believe about 16% or maybe a little more of the index is energy. And so some of that reduction in inflation, price inflation, is due to the present administration sacrificing our petroleum reserves, emergency reserves, to hold prices down or to lower them, whatever they could. And second, I think food costs are going to go up because Ukraine violated the grain deal by using ocean-going drones to attack the civilian infrastructure of the Kerch Bridge. And so now the grain supply is going to be at a much higher price.
Jim, thanks for the call. And Russia, of course, attacking Ukrainian grain supplies and backing out of a deal. Let's start with that oil point. First of all, Lydia, one of the least predictable things out there, I'm looking at a chart of oil prices. It goes up and down a lot. How much is something like releasing some strategic oil reserves, or, as our caller mentioned, going to help bring that price down and help bring overall inflation down?
Yeah, I mean, using the Strategic Petroleum Reserve to try to bring more supply onto the market, which obviously had been constrained by global disruptions, it was widely credited for being fairly successful, right? It's very difficult for the president to control the price of anything because it is so subject to global supply and demand, from how fast China is growing to how much supply OPEC wants to put on the market. So Jim is right that was a huge factor in overall prices coming down. Where that goes in the future, it's not really clear, because other types of energy are starting to become increasingly important when it comes to fueling our cars or heating our homes. And yes, there's a big concern that food prices will go up because of continued fighting in Ukraine, and most recently, as you noted, the determination by the Russians to stop the grain trade. But that might be a bigger problem, to be honest, for some of the emerging markets that really depend on that grain, and Europe. The U.S. obviously is a huge producer of food in its own right.
Thanks for that call. Jeff joins us in Superior. Jeff, hi.
Hi, good afternoon. I love talking about this. It's so important for us to be educated. Our GDP is about $34 trillion a year. My question is, the money that is in circulation in our economy, how does that affect inflation? every year.
Jeff, thanks for the... Oh, go ahead.
Oh, yeah, no, thank you, Jeff. I mean, I think that it's a big blunt instrument, right? The money supply classically was usually thought of as the main, maybe even sole driver of price growth or degrowth. And I think that things have gotten more complicated. And there's a lot more factors that are on a micro level going to influence day-to-day changes. Now, the Federal Reserve has been raising interest rates, so that means sort of gradually reducing the money supply. You might attribute the sinking inflation to that in part, but we don't really know how much of that has sunk in yet, right? The classic Milton Friedman dictum that changes in interest rates act with long and variable lags, that might have sped up because information flow has increased in recent years, which means that the transmission from monetary policy into markets might have been accelerated, right? So if you were keeping an eye on your 401k last year, you probably noticed it was much smaller at the end of 2022 than it was at the beginning. And that's because monetary policy had an impact on the price of equities. So it's a fair question, but I do think it's just much more complicated than we once thought it was.
Thanks for the call, Jeff. Talk about inflation with Lydia DePillis with the business desk at the New York Times. Lydia, I want to touch on a few different angles of inflation. This idea was around before COVID, shrinkflation. The idea like, okay, hey, this box of cereal costs the same as it used to. Hey, wait a minute, it's got 4 ounces less cereal in it. A sort of sneaky way to deal with inflation. How big a factor is that?
Yeah, I mean, it's something that our federal data agencies don't really track. Mm-hmm. But, you know, your grocery store should have a price per ounce so you can actually tell whether that's going up or down. So I think that was a clever workaround, especially in that sort of consumer packaged goods category where, you know, you notice your box of grape nuts, it looks a little bit smaller, but you can't really tell because it's the same dimensions. So that kind of thing probably is one of the more sticky ways in which companies have managed to sell less but make more. and so I think that's the kind of thing that you should keep a really close eye on. There's a bunch of websites that track this sort of thing. So if you're really into getting more for your money, make sure you don't get deceived by that kind of tactic.
I mentioned shrinkflation. There's greedflation, a lot of others. Last month, the Guardian newspaper reported that people in Sweden were blaming inflation on a Beyonce concert in Stockholm, calling it Beyonce-flation. Are we reaching peak prefix-flation use here? Are we overdoing this?
Well, I think where everyone is certainly sick of this inflationary moment and would like everything to get back to normal. I mean, the Beyonce episode to me was more an illustration of how national markets for extremely popular things have just made prices for that kind of exceptional item with limited supply, right? There's only so many seats at a Beyonce concert. Incredibly expensive, right? We all know about the same things now. So there's sort of less diversity in cultural output in a way. Like just think about the Barbie movie this past weekend, right? We're all because we all are tuned into the same social media and TV channels, know that this thing is really exciting. And so I'm sure prices for movie tickets will probably show a bump just for the month of July.
Speaking of tickets, you wrote earlier this month about plane tickets, a summer drop in airfare prices after them going, seemed like up and up. What's going on?
Yeah, I mean, and that's an example of a market where there's a lot going on, right? Both on the supply and the demand side. I think, though, that this year it is really a normalization of the supply side, where airlines have figured out how to keep their, you know, pilot rosters full and stewardesses and, you know, ground crews, obviously not without hiccups. There's been plenty of that. But after a situation where they went from a total icy freeze in 2020, mothballed a bunch of planes, and then had to come out of that in the middle of emergence from the pandemic, huge surge in demand. All those forces are kind of normalizing now. And now all we have to worry about is giant storms and runways that are too hot to fly on. And I just, you know, one thing I will note on that is that a big lurking force here is actually climate change, because that's a really disruptive force when it comes to the supply of all kinds of things, from food to energy to housing to cars, right? If you have a hurricane, it wipes out a bunch of homes and cars. So that's the kind of thing that economists are worried that in the long term will keep price growth higher, because we just have these big whacks to the supply of things we need.
One bit of economic news just out here. People have been worried about a UPS strike. Could have been a big shock, a lot of disruption to the economy and the supply chain. Looks like there's a deal. That strike will not happen. They've reached an agreement. How big a deal is it that we're going to avoid that six-digit 340,000 worker strike?
Yeah, no, that's huge news. I'm sitting here in the Times newsroom, and there was a kerfuffle when it happened, because we'd prepared for what the consequences of a long-term strike would be, and it would be really significant because we all depend so much now on package delivery, is increasingly since the pandemic, right? And so, but it's also great news for labor. You know, I'm not super familiar yet with the details of the deal, but it sounds like those workers got something that they were satisfied with. And that's good news for the sustainability of wage increases. We've got a few more labor discussions on the horizon. The United Auto Workers are also entering bargaining with the big three automakers. So we'll see what happens there, because that's something that could really impact the price of cars if they decide that they're not getting what they want from their employers. So, you know, it's been quite an interesting summer of strikes and almost strikes. And I do think that it says a lot about how much workers want from this economy, where they see prices, where they see companies raking in profits and they have the same expenses.
Lydia, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us.
Sure thing.
That's Lydia DePillis, a reporter on the business desk at the New York Times. She joined us today for a look at what's going on with inflation lately, what it all means for the U.S. economy and for you. Coming up after the news, we get the latest on criminal investigations into former President Trump and attempts to overturn the 2020 election. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, the World Health Organization has made a pair of recent recommendations about artificial sweeteners like aspartame. We'll talk to a Wisconsin biochemist about how our bodies process alternatives to sugar and what they mean for our health. Now, former President Donald Trump is facing another potential indictment. Federal officials are investigating Trump's involvement in the events leading up to the Capitol riot on January 6th. Plus, Michigan's Democratic Attorney General Dana Nessel is charging 16 false electors with forgery felonies for efforts to overturn the state's 2020 presidential results. We're digging into some of the political and legal questions surrounding those cases, and you can join in at 800-642-1234. What would you like to know about the federal probe into Trump's actions after the 2020 elections leading up to January 6th? Should the former president be federally indicted? Does it matter that he's a leading candidate for president in his party right now? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. Paul Nolet is an associate professor of political science at Marquette University. Paul, welcome back to Central Time.
Hello. Great to be here.
We have this target letter the former president says he's received from special counsel Jack Smith. What do we know at this point about this investigation into Trump and a potential indictment?
Well, we know that this is a big deal, first of all. This is an investigation that's been going on for quite some time now. Jack Smith has been interviewing dozens of witnesses as part of this. And so we're all waiting for the actual results here. What might the charges be? But at this point, we know that there's been a long time investigation of course, a former president and perhaps future presidential candidate here. So this is really unprecedented in American history.
Let's talk about the process a little bit. Merrick Garland, the attorney general, didn't seem like he was in a hurry to investigate or charge these things for the former president. Gets into the presidential race. Garland hands it over to this special counsel. Can you talk about that? Does that make a difference in terms of the independence of this investigation?
Yeah, I think Merrick Garland, I mean, he certainly realized the difficulty and the unprecedented nature of this investigation, and so wanted to put as many layers of independence between the investigation and the Department of Justice and the Biden administration more generally. And so when Merrick Garland appointed Jack Smith, it was very much with that in mind. And what that allows is it allows Jack Smith, who's, you know, a very experienced counsel, it allows him more freedom, more independence to carry out this investigation, not only independence from the administration, but more independence from charges that he's politically motivated. Of course, those charges are still coming. Former President Trump has certainly had many things to say about Jack Smith. But nevertheless, those additional layers in a case like this were, in Merrick Garland's estimation, very much necessary before the whole thing could begin.
The target letter I mentioned includes a few possible lines of inquiry here and charges, including deprivation of rights, conspiracy to defraud the United States, and witness tampering. Now, we won't know until when and if indictments are issued what exactly they'll be, but what are your thoughts on those as the sort of lines of investigation?
Yeah, they're very interesting. I mean, the deprivation of rights, I think, was particularly surprising. That's based upon a Civil War era statute that originally was meant to target the KKK and domestic terrorism, particularly against recently freed slaves. And so that statute has been on the books for quite some time. And I think the potential theory there is that the deprivation of rights could be that it's depriving people essentially of voting rights by trying to overturn an election. So I think that's one of the juicier potential charges here. And, you know, the other ones I think are consistent with what a lot of, when Congress was investigating this as part of the January 6th committee investigating what happened during the assault on the Capitol, there were some recommended charges there as well, including inciting insurrection, obstruction of official proceeding of Congress. And so all of these, so what we know already as from the target letter and what we know from the January 6th commission, any of those potential charges could be part of an actual indictment. So we'll have to wait and see to see what we actually get, but these would very much be very juicy, very major charges.
Talking to Paul Nolet from Marquette University, looking at current and potential future charges against former President Trump. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller now. Dennis is with us in Two Rivers. Dennis, hi.
Hi, thanks. The thing is, Trump keeps trying to obstruct, and if Trump gets to have the any of the trials pushed till after the election, then Trump or some other Republican is probably going to offer up or even write out a pardon.
Dennis, thanks a lot for the call. And Paul, with an existing set of indictments now, these related to the removal of classified documents, the ones at Mar-a-Lago, and obstruction of justice related to those. The former president, his legal team tried to get that trial pushed back past, as Dennis said, past the next presidential election. Jack Smith wanted it. The special counsel wanted it earlier. The judge in the case seems to have split the difference May of next year, right in the middle of the presidential, the primary campaign there. The timing and the efforts to hold off these trials, what do you think?
Yeah, I mean, this just raises so many questions for sure. And there's going to be a lot of this back and forth between the legal teams to try to, you know, scurry for advantage one way or another. But absolutely, I mean, we're faced, even in the other trial, we'll see what happens with this one. But in the documents case, exactly, May 20th, we're set for the trial. I mean, that's exactly around the time that you would typically know who the nominee for the parties would be. And it very well is looking like at this point that it could be Donald Trump. And so that timing is very interesting in the lead up to the November elections. And then some of the questions that, you know, Dennis raised there about whether, let's say that Trump was elected again, he becomes president, would he be able to pardon himself? I mean, how would this work in the federal cases? those are all questions that have never been addressed before in American history. So they are weighty questions and really difficult ones as well.
Thanks for that call, Dennis, at 800-642-1234. Another thread, a legal thread, coming out of the 2020 elections. We had multiple states where Joe Biden won. Republicans, electors gathered, signed paperwork declaring themselves the electors. In one state, Pennsylvania, they said, if the court overturns the outcome as we see it now, the rest of the states, including Wisconsin, they didn't. Now, here's Michigan, another one of those states. The attorney general there filed criminal charges against these electors. People have called them the fake electors for this effort. What do you think of it's been quite a while now. What do you think of those charges being filed? What does this mean?
Yeah, I mean, it's showing that the universe of potential cases here is very large. I mean, the Department of Justice on the federal level has been charging a number of people involved in the January 6th insurrection. So that's been ongoing. But now with the state of Michigan, their attorney general bringing charges against these so-called fake electors, that really raises the bar for expanding this outward in a number of ways. And I say that in relation to the Jack Smith federal investigation as well, because one thing to remember here is that we know that Trump got a target letter because Trump was very vocal about this on social media about how he got this target letter. But there very well may be others that received target letters and are just being quiet about it. We know that Smith's investigation wasn't just of Trump and of January 6th, but the broader effort to potentially overturn an election. And so I think the Michigan action may throw another wrinkle into the whole thing about how some of these fake electors may be targeted even federally for potentially their role in overturning an election.
Now, the argument there, Paul, I think is, if I was one of the people who would sign one of these, I would say, and many of them have, no, we were just signing this thing. So it was there. If one of these long shot court cases did tip the balance, then we're not, left without electors in the event that somehow Trump ended up prevailing in a state like Michigan or Wisconsin. Other people have pointed toward the effort to hand these lists of electors, these statements by these Republican non-electors to Vice President Pence, an aide to Wisconsin Senator Ron Johnson, tried to communicate that to Mike Pence on January 6th and pointing toward this as, no, this is a conspiracy to overturn the election. How do courts, if it comes to that, weigh those two arguments?
Yeah, I mean, and this is going to be where it's really interesting in the federal investigation, whether they've introduced any new facts when we see an indictment. I mean, if the documents case is any indication here, Jack Smith is quite willing to put out what are often referred to as talking indictments or speaking indictments. Essentially, they're telling a story about what happened, putting all the facts together and saying how it all comes together in these charges. One thing that'll be really interesting to see is whether there's additional evidence about how these fake electors acted. And that evidence might help courts to figure out who's telling the truth here. Was this just an effort to try to, put something out there in case courts overturn some of the elections results from the 2020 election? Or were they going even further in a way that was knowingly trying to overturn a lawful election? And so those additional facts, they could be in any indictment, and that'll be something very much to look out for.
Paul Nolette is with us, Associate Professor of Political Science at Marquette University. We're talking about former President Trump's current and potential criminal indictments and other cases related to the 2020 election outcome. You can join in at 800-642-1234. We were just talking about those self-appointed alternate electors. Should Wisconsin's Republicans who signed on to these elector papers face criminal charges as those in Michigan did? What questions do you have about potential new charges or the existing indictments against former President Trump? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk with Paul Nolet, Associate Professor of Political Science at Marquette University. We're talking about former President Trump's legal troubles as he faces another possible federal indictment, this one stemming from efforts to overturn the 2020 election outcome. You can join in with your thoughts, your questions at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Let's go back to your calls now. George is with us in Ashland. George, hi.
Hi. So when he declared his candidacy, Mr. Trump, it seemed exceedingly early, almost 2 years before the election. And I wondered if you could comment on whether you see that as having been part of his legal strategy as a defense against his legal issues. Thank you.
Thanks for the call, George. What do you think, Paul?
Yeah, I think that that's true. I mean, there's a couple things going on here. We know that Trump very much likes campaigning. He likes talking to large crowds and that sort of thing. And so that's probably part of why he wanted to declare early. But absolutely, I mean, by declaring early and becoming a candidate, that put additional pressure on the Department of Justice when it was thinking about its legal strategy. And, you know, that eventually led to, as we talked about before, you know, Merrick Garland appointing Jack Smith as the special counsel here. So I do think that that was part of the strategy, knowing Trump, knowing that there were going to be legal ramifications for a number of things once he was no longer president. This complicates matter when he's not only a candidate for the presidency, but far and away the leading candidate currently for the Republican nomination.
Thanks for that call. Logan from Madison called in, couldn't stay on the line. Logan says it feels like investigations into President Joe Biden and his family aren't getting the same level of attention as Trump's investigations. And Paul, there's a couple lines going on there. First of all, we had a federal prosecutor, a Trump appointee. The Biden Justice Department left him in power in Delaware, in effect, to complete that investigation of Hunter Biden. And then we've got investigations in the U.S. House looking at various accusations related to Hunter Biden, mostly some they say to Joe Biden. Are we paying enough attention to that now?
Well, I think at the end of the day, what matters are the facts. And, you know, as you mentioned, the House is currently undergoing an investigation of Biden and family members. And there have been investigations ongoing for quite some time. So I think at the end of the day, whatever facts are going to be uncovered is going to help drive the coverage here. And again, we don't know all the facts from the Jack Smith investigation either. We know a number of facts from the January 6th committee that eventually submitted an over 800-page report that had a number of concerning aspects about a number of people that potentially were involved in trying to overturn an election. So I think at the end of the day, you know, the facts will speak, and whether if there is anything there with Biden and family members in that investigation, then you know, that'll help drive the level of coverage, I think, and the seriousness of any potential charges related to those.
Talking to political scientist Paul Nolet from Marquette University, looking at the latest legal inquiries, possible new set of indictments coming for former President Trump. Paul, let's look at the current set out there. First of all, the federal indictments into the classified documents case, as we mentioned, this case going to trial May 20th. I think you said the judge said, hey, this is a complex case. There's a lot. We're going to need a good long time. What happens between now and that trial so many months away?
Yeah, and that's where I think, you know, you're going to have the sides wrangling kind of legally over process, but also over substance as well, in terms of how they present their cases and organize and marshal the evidence before the trial. And, you know, thinking about it politically as well, it's such an awkward thing, as we talked about before, where this could be right around the moment that Trump perhaps has the nomination wrapped up. And so I think part of the strategizing there is not just legally, but politically on the part of the Department of Justice. You know, what gaming out of a variety of different scenarios. What if Trump isn't the nominee? What if he is the nominee? You know, and thinking about how that might affect the legal strategy here. And one other thing that I'd mentioned as well, the Manhattan case, so the falsifying business records case, that was brought by Alvin Bragg, the local prosecutor. You know, the twist there, those charges, I would say, you know, aren't nearly to the level, in my estimation, as the documents case and especially the election case ongoing at the federal level. But the twist is that while, you know, Trump becoming president and potentially pardoning himself or stopping these investigations at the federal level might be a possibility, the president doesn't have that sort of power to stop a state investigation. Mm-hmm. So that does add an additional twist to the whole situation as well. And we also shouldn't forget that there's an ongoing investigation in Georgia as well pertaining to the election. And the prosecutors there said that there could be potential indictments as early as mid-August. So that's another legal twist to the whole situation.
A question that our listeners bring up sometimes is, if a person is under indictment or if a person is found guilty of felonies, does that prevent that person from running for president and if winning, becoming president? And my understanding is, nope, not at all. You can run for president from a prison cell if you want to.
Yes. In fact, that has a clear and short answer. No, it does not prevent a person running for president. The Constitution has a very limited number of qualifications. You know, natural born citizen, 35 years old. But if the person is under federal indictment or even in prison, that does not prevent somebody from running for president and potentially even winning and becoming president while in prison. So all of these are, I mean, they almost seem like fantasy. If you went back 10 years ago and brought up these scenarios, mm-hmm. it would be really fanciful. But here we are in potentially facing these sorts of questions.
We've focused mostly on the legal side of things today, Paul. I want to get into a little of the politics because it's certainly there. We've got a big and it seems like ever-growing field of candidates in this Republican primary. A lot of those candidates being very careful. They want to win the nomination instead of former President Trump. Only a couple of them, and seems like a couple of the long shots, willing to criticize the president. A lot of the other candidates defending the former president, saying he shouldn't be subject to these criminal charges. How is this all affecting the politics of this Republican primary campaign?
Yeah, and I think really a lot of these candidates are just trying to balance the fact that Trump remains a very popular figure amongst the Republican base, overwhelmingly so, with the you know, possibility that Trump could implode. Of course, we've said that many times before. But I do think, you know, with these election-related charges, this potentially could change the dynamic in ways that the other investigations didn't. Now, I'm certainly not guaranteeing that mm-hmm. would happen. We've seen so far that when these indictments, the previous two, came down, that Trump actually moved up in the polls. But there's a possibility that there could be a Trump weariness going on even amongst Republican voters. And if that does happen, then there's a number of candidates, as you mentioned, that are there to pick up the slack. And so a lot of them are in this holding pattern where they can't criticize Trump, but they want him to implode at the same time. So it's a difficult balancing act.
Do you think, just in our last minute, there's something in the nature of potential indictments over the 2020 election outcome that would work differently, that would read differently?
Yeah, I do, because number one, it deals with the election and certain types of very sensitive conspiracy theories that get to voting rights and that sort of thing. But also it brings up the specter again of January 6th and what happened on that day. And that's something that I don't think a lot of Republicans want to talk about. Republicans that were very willing in the week or so after January 6th to criticize openly Donald Trump. And so it'll bring back a lot of that a lot of Republicans don't necessarily want to bring up in the context of a presidential campaign.
Paul, we'll leave it there. Thanks, as always, for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
That's Paul Nolet, Marquette University Associate Professor of Political Science. We've been talking about the legal cases surrounding former President Trump and efforts to overturn the 2020 presidential election, plus charges in our neighboring state, Michigan, against the Republicans who signed on as electors, even though President Biden had won their state. Coming up tomorrow on The Morning Show with Kate Archer-Kent, so-called artificial intelligence programs are shaking up the media world, and they're playing a part in the ongoing strikes in the entertainment industry, the writers and actors strikes. Get the latest on AI, artificial intelligence, how it's being used, especially when it comes to the creative industry and for media and reporting now, and join in with your questions and your reactions. Join that conversation tomorrow morning at 8 here on the Ideas Network. It's Tuesday, and maybe you're thinking of having tacos for dinner. But can you legally call it Taco Tuesday? After a settlement reached last week, you are in the clear. As reported by NPR, the chain Taco John's held a trademark to the phrase Taco Tuesday going back to 1989, except in New Jersey for some reason. That meant that other restaurants and bars faced legal risk if they advertised the phrase Taco Tuesday. But the much larger chain Taco Bell issued a legal challenge saying Taco Tuesday is a common phrase, shouldn't be subject to trademark. Taco John's announced they'd give up that trademark last week, declaring themselves to be, quote, lovers, not fighters. Now, of course, if you'd wanted to declare your family dinner night to be Taco Tuesday, no one's going to sue you for that, unless you advertise it and charge people to sit at your kitchen table. A happy Taco Tuesday to all who celebrate. This is Central Time.